Eric.
Hey, Charles.
How are you doing, man?
You're great.
Excellent. So we're in building one.
Yes, we're here with Don Box.
All right.
Now, for the longest time, we wanted to do, when I was Head in the Box, we wanted to do Head in the Box with Box.
Well, actually, my idea was that we would do a video with me in the toilet, and me Box on the head. Right? That would have been the perfect compliment.
Nice. Yes. Duality.
Yes, exactly. But it took a while, but now finally we're here.
Okay.
So Don, this is something that was always on my mind to ask you, Jack. What is the simple in soap? Where does that come from?
Oh, great. Interesting question. If you look at where we were in 1998 when we started soap, I mean, it's been 11 years since I remember flying up. Dave Weiner and I flew up and we met with Mohsen Alghossein and Bob Atkinson. You know, we basically said, what would it look like to go get off of these binary protocols? Because you have to remember, in the mid-90s, you know, there was the CORBA versus DCOM wars.
Yep.
And, you know, DSOM and a bunch of other things were coming out. And all of these were, you know, binary protocols all the way to the bottom. They built from TCP/IP up. And, you know, we said, look, the web is catching on. You know, this was, in 98, it was, you know, it was still somewhat nascent. As now we just take it as axiomatic in the world. And so we said, how are we going to leverage that? I mean, our litmus test was, could I build a, you know, interesting app server on Apache? Right? That, for me, I thought, okay, great, I'm going to go do this on Apache. I wound up doing other things instead with it. But and so we said, look, HTTP, great. That thing is ubiquitous. Let's go take advantage of that. In retrospect, we didn't take enough advantage of it, which is, you know, you know, hindsight is 20/20. And XML was pretty nascent, but it looked like it was going to be huge. And you have to remember, in '98, Bosworth was here at the firm, and you know was beginning the XML wave. He was actually pretty well into it by then. And so we said, look, here's something that looks like it's of the web, which is XML. The protocol we use for doing data interchange is of the web. We're doing HTTP, and let's go. And so we started with very, you know, good intentions. And it started out relatively simple. You know, the first SOAP spec was effectively what XML RPC was. Right? If you go look at the XML RPC spec, we kind of started from that, roughly that design point. There were some very attractive things about XML RPC in retrospect. One was, it was much more self-describing than most XML is, right? Most XML, you know, you just see string values, and you can't tell whether it's an int, and so you can't do equivalence. There's a bunch of things that you can't do, and sometimes that's a bug, sometimes that's a feature. You know, we had a little bit more self-description in the original XML RPC format. You know, we did an iteration of it, and I thought the first iteration was pretty reasonable. Whistle happened, quite honestly. two things for me took the simple out of SOAP. And by the way, for SOAP 1.2, we revoked the acronym status. It basically just became a word, just like, strangely enough, when Olay went from Olay 1 to Olay 2, or Olay 3, whatever it was, we revoked its acronym status as well. Once we did WSDL and took a bet on XML schema, that's where the complexity curve of the protocol went up. So if I could go back, right, the two things I would have done differently were, I would have taken a deeper bet on HTTP than we did. Right, I would have embraced GET. I would have been much more embracing of the way URIs work. We, you know, we obviously use URIs in SOAP, but we could have taken a deeper bet on them. We didn't. I don't know what I would have done about the WSDL XSD thing. Those two things together. Well, actually, the deeper commitment to HTTP would have been a good long term bet. It would have probably accelerated the progress. But for me, the real decelerator, in terms of just getting absolute ubiquity where everybody does SOAP and it's just unquestioned, was absolutely the SOAP and the XSD and WSDL thing. You basically have two pretty clear. The problem is XSD is the biggest, was really the killer. WSDL, you couldn't fix it.
Yeah.
And there are, if you look at WSDL 1.1, there were attempts to fix the XSD problem, but wasn't possible.
Yeah. So it's interesting you say, like, you would have made a deeper bet on HTTP. One of the things that surprised me, because I was doing web stuff like in 97 too, but then I completely missed JSON. I mean, like, and I, as you know, I fell for the XML thing too. But like, yeah. How could we, mesh yes. JSON? I mean, why were we so blind?
I don't know. It is so utterly cool that it was there in front of us.
Yes.
But I mean, look. To be honest, you know, late '90s, JavaScript and HTML were actually starting to develop. Kind of, they were kind of in the disillusionment phase of the cycle. Right. Gartner has this, you know, five phase cycle. And I would definitely say the late '90s, probably even into the early 2000s, we were in kind of the disillusionment phase, and so people weren't looking there as a place to solve their problems. You know, in retrospect, again, you know, we kind of came out of that, and now it's again, it's axiomatic, right? JavaScript is axiomatic in the world, right? If you deny its existence, you will perish. Same with HTML, same with HTTP, and there aren't that many axioms in the world, and but it takes a while for them to become axiomatic. But yeah, it's amazing. It was just this thing. It was lying there, and Doug Crockford just said, "I'll take that." It's brilliant. It is utterly brilliant. So yeah,
good. Yeah, no, I agree.
Right, it's like,
I forgot about that. I forgot about when I met you, which was at Uppsala, 2001. Actually, that was where I met you and Clement Shapersky, who works on just around the corner.
I just saw him there. Yeah,
yeah, you were doing. You were working with Wolfram. In fact, I met, it was you, Wolfram, and Clemens, and you and Wolfram were doing the, you had a different AB even before X-Sharp.
Yes.
What was it back then?
Well, so we called it XML for C-Sharp or something. That was like when we first tried to kind of put XML into C-Sharp, and that became X-Sharp and Link and whatever. So that was like, Don was the first one that we dared to show it to. because he was like all into XSD by, at that time, too.
Yeah, unfortunately. But
yes.
Yeah. No, it was that was fun. I remember, we got drunk one night too, as I recall.
Yeah.
There was an MSR dinner that we went to, and I remember you guys were kind enough to invite me, even though I wasn't. I didn't work at Microsoft, and B, it was clear I was not smart enough to be an MSR. So.
Yeah. But then, soon thereafter, he joined Microsoft, so that kind of worked.
And now you're a distinguished engineer, so let's not talk about smarts. You have plenty of them.
But anyway, so since XSD, you've been doing a lot of type systems. So, is there anything that you're kind of chasing that, you know, you were, like, traumatized by XSD or,
Oh, look, I learned a bunch of lessons from XML schema. The two biggest lessons I learned, well, three. One was it's very difficult to do design work in a standards body, right?
Yep.
The number of things that went in unbaked and came out baked by a standards body is very, very low. I'm sure there are success stories, but there are a lot of failure stories. So, you know, I was on the schema working group and you know, watched the sausage being made and helped make some of it. I don't think I would ever go into, a design effort in a standards body with so little nailed down. I think standard bodies add a tremendous value, but you can't start from the seed. You need a much stronger amount of seed material than we had with XML Schema Working Group, where you basically had four very different input documents, and then, you know, let's go try and figure it out.
Yeah.
So that was lesson number one, is don't do it in a standards body. Standards bodies play a role, but it ain't at the beginning. Number two was economy of mechanism. One thing we wound up doing in XML Schema was we had a scenario, so let's invent a new language mechanism. And so you see... that proliferation show up in things like the fact that there are both element substitution groups and the complex type hierarchy. And anytime you have to tell someone about how XML schema works, you wind up drawing the two trees and the arrows from the two of them. It's pretty ucky. So economy of mechanism, you know, do more with less. And then the third one is pretty interesting because many people on the working group had a certain mentality, including myself, and I now realize I was wrong, although some people didn't see it this way. There was an assumption in the XML by many people in the XML schema working group that you have an untyped value, a document, an info set, whatever you want to call it, and then you view it, you basically apply the XML schema to it, and you get this new value, and that's the value. Right, and so there's this whole notion of post-schema validation info set, PSVI, where we basically alter the document. And that in and of itself isn't a terrible worldview, but then we did things like inject XML schemaisms into the value space. So you see things like XSI type, which is the most obvious example, where you're basically now making the commitments to the interpretation in the value space. And so you get this really weird coupling. And there's a virtue to having a data-oriented world where there can be a value. Like, let me show you a value. Here's a value which I'm going to put between Eric and myself. I look at that as, actually, let me pick a different one. I'm going to pick this cup because my analogy will not work with that one. Okay. I'm going to put this one and delicately balance it, and I will pull it down in a moment.
In there or something? Yeah.
It's Diet Coke.
Okay.
So I see that's a green cup, right? And I expect to work in terms of green cups. Eric cares about cups of Coke, Diet Coke, or actually containers of Diet Coke. Turns out this value conforms to both of our expectations, and we're able to do some amount of meaningful work with this thing because I see it, I need a green cup, you need a container full of Diet Coke. And that ability to apply multiple interpretations on top of a single value was originally a design goal of a lot of the folks who did XML, and it got lost by the XML schema working group. And so you'd like there to be a world where I've got a value, a document or a cup, and different people can apply different interpretations to it so that the data can live longer than a particular specification of the data. And so we kind of got that wrong in XML schema. However, there were people who had that worldview. Noah Mendelson is one of my favorite examples. Noah's a great guy, brilliant guy, IBMer. And I remember I have some moments in my life where someone makes a statement and I just have a very deep epiphany. One of them was when Noah was at a DevCon that we were at, and he walked through this worldview of single document, multiple schemas, use multiple schemas in different parts of the processing pipeline. It was just, for me, like, oh my God, we kind of bollocks this up a little bit.
It's interesting. I don't know, we've seen Gilad Braga on Channel 9 a couple of times. This is exactly what he talks about when he talks about optional and layered type systems. So it's like the optionality is that you should not inject things from the type system into
the value space.
And it's layered because you can have different views, different type systems on the same value. So it's interesting that this kind of, Gilad has been chasing that kind of dream also for a long time with NewSpeak and so on.
Absolutely.
So that's good. So now, so from XSD, then you started to work on Atlas. Should we kind of, follow, or should
you
we jump
in? Do your show.
Yes. Well, okay. So I would like to also talk a little bit about like WCF and distributed computing. That's kind of one of my hot topics at this point. So what is your feeling about like the state of the world in terms of distributed computing? So where do you see are the biggest pain points?
Oh, wow. Let me context switch. Look, I think there's a bunch of challenges. The one that's closest to my heart is I think the languages that we use to express our ideas are make a different set of commitments than you would make if you were trying to go build these kinds of systems. So for me, it's like when I have a vision in my head of how I want a system to work, and then I go to commit it into C#, I feel like I'm encoding, right? Mm-hmm. To use the Simone analogy, right? We call people coders because they are encrypting, something that's very clear in someone's mind into something that's completely undecipherable. And the amount of translation it takes to get over that hump, I think we have lots of opportunity to improve. And by the way, it's same for Java, same for a lot of languages.
So it means that there are certain kind of abstractions or things that you think are relevant that are kind of not apparent in the programming language. So what would that kind of be? So when you're saying you're encoding, what concepts do you feel are missing in the programming in C# or?
Well, I don't know if it's missing. I just think that the commitments you would make if you were building a language for distributed programming, I believe, are different than the ones you would make for kind of where we all came from, which was, you know, a natural evolution from structured programming into OO. One thing I've been thinking about lately is, you know, the web, as I've mentioned, is axiomatic, right? I can't deny it. If you deny its existence, then you can't be watching this video because you're watching it over the web. So you're delusional already. You know, I think certain ideas in the web have a lot of legs. And so the notion of a resource locators, you know, I wonder whether that should be library or language, right? So I think there's some opportunity there. Obviously, the asynchrony, you know, the latency issues are huge. Concurrency issues are huge. You know, one of the things I work on here at Microsoft, we're building this tool called Quadrant. And Quadrant's a database tool, right? And building that tool, watching the team go through the design arc has been fascinating. Because we took a system that was built largely for interacting with information that was typically fairly close, typically low concurrency, not no concurrency, but not highly concurrent. And we took a set of infrastructure built with that set of assumptions and then built a database tool on top of it. And it was pretty interesting. We basically had to learn the lessons the hard way that latency is real. Latency is very, very real, as is failure in communication, right? All the standard, you know, the Waldo fallacies, yep. Right? The team had to learn them. And you can't tell someone this. I mean, that's really it's very hard to tell anyone anything, right? People have to learn it themselves. So the team got to go through the arc of, latency is real, great. Concurrency is real. And so the design of the tool has evolved quite a bit from, like, even from PDC 2008, where we had a fairly tightly coupled architecture relative to the database, which, by the way, is a distributed server. I mean, it's sitting on a different box typically.
Yeah.
To where we are at, and you know, we're going to have another version of PDC 2009. It's dramatically different, and by embracing, so in terms of systems building, right, we pivoted around, you know, distribution as the norm, right? It's very rare that we're actually closed. It's very rare that we actually don't have concurrency conflicts. And building the tool that way was liberating because the tool got useful so much faster. However, we had to write a lot of C# code to go make that work, right? And we had to invent a lot of abstraction that was not in either the language nor the frameworks to get a reasonable experience. And so, you know, my suspicion is people are going to keep building these systems. The good news is, at least in terms of like the world of data and data accessy kinds of things, and I use that term fairly loosely, you know, there's kind of a growing, you know, best practice that's emerged, and I think, you know, we're close to a point where we should start codifying that a little bit lower in the stack as opposed to just building, you know, more and more framework gunk on top of it.
But so, well, if we look at the past, like I think in the 90s, a lot of people were arguing that we should separate computation and coordination. And I think if you program in C#, it's very tempting to just, you know, glue everything into one giant mess. And what you're saying, the way I interpret it, that you discovered that you have to separate computation and coordination. And the coordination is the glue that deals with the latency and asynchronousy. And then, you know, in the leaves, you're still doing normal imperative computations, but the way you glue them together is factored out. Is that a correct?
That sounds very plausible. Yeah. I would never use any of the words you just used, Eric, but I sat here and my head was nodding. Yeah, it sounds reasonable.
Yeah. And so you said, like, you know, you needed to build a lot of libraries. For example, you know, like if you're doing asynchronous programming, that's I think one of the topics that's kind of dear to my heart, because if you look at the way we have to do that right now with callbacks or begin invoke, end invoke, and so on. So did you guys come up with a solution to
that
problem?
Yeah, well, it's awesome you ask. One of the other limitations of the PDC 08 build a quadrant was there wasn't we didn't embrace asynchrony, right? You know, we had some machinery in there, but when we rebuilt the data pipeline inside the tool for this release, we basically did it asynchronous by default. In fact, I think the current framework we're using has no synchronous APIs. right? So you basically construct a functional query expression that you hand off to the system, and you register the place where we're going to start pumping data back into, and the data pumps in asynchronously. You get partial results. Another really interesting challenge, which isn't so. By the way, that I think is fairly traditional, and you know there are things we could have done in Indigo to make that even smoother. But the one interesting issue we hit on Quadrant, which you don't typically hear talked about as much in kind of the distributed research area, is the data volume problem, right? We're building a tool to go talk to databases, and databases have lots of stuff in them, and that stuff I can't bring over in one fell swoop, and often I don't even want to.
Yeah.
Right. So it's not even a matter of dealing with the latency; it's dealing with the resource consumption. I just don't have enough virtual memory to deal with it. So we've also done a lot of work on data virtualization and the ability to effectively hit a query which represents gigabytes or more worth of resultant data, and then coming up with new paradigms for interacting with that. It's been a really fun project to work on.
Yeah, I can. And another thing there is when you talk about distributed systems, is dealing with exceptions or errors. Which in the normal programming languages usually that's exceptional, but if you're looking at distributed system, it's more the norm, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Your connections are always down, or you time out, or so do you think that we need a new way to deal with exceptions, or are exceptions still exceptions? Is that the right word?
I don't know. Yeah, that's a great question. I haven't spent much time thinking about it. I know when we built Quadrant, We built it with the expectations of errors. And because the one of the things we were wrestling with was concurrency, we basically said we're going to embrace optimistic concurrency, not a big surprise. And in that world, your life is all about conflict, concurrency conflicts.
Yep.
And so it's very funny, when I remember when we were doing that design work, the analogy we always used was our source code control system. Source Depot, which is the magnificent source code control system my team uses. The metaphors we would use as we talked about the design was, SD resolve, A, Y, M, and all that nomenclature, because, source code control systems are, a place where concurrency conflicts are the norm, and, the world, I think, has mostly gone to a world where we don't do pessimistic locking in source code control. And so we kind of looked at that as, that system works, people know how to use it, and so we kind of tried to be inspired by that user model, which meant, we embraced conflicts. In fact, in Quadrant, what's really funny is I can be looking at I can have a query, looks at a piece of data, and I can make new queries, and sometimes the queries overlap, and so we do all the rendezvous to make sure that we get, coherency on the client. But what's interesting is if I do a second query that overlaps the data I've already seen, but the results give me a new, basically have shown me that something's moved out from underneath me. We actually did work in the UX to basically say, okay, this data's stale, right? Or if you've got an outstanding edit. So we actually plumbed the concurrency model through the UX, which was it was a lot of fun. I think it yields a better experience.
So and kind of going further about data. So one of the things you've also been working on is modeling and the M language.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us a little bit more? How did that evolve since the last PDC? And
oh, great. Okay. At PDC, we shipped the first version of our compiler to folks. We've been pretty active since PDC. The compiler we're shipping at this PDC has some of the seams in the language are gone. We had some interesting modalities in the language where if you were using this feature, the language worked a certain way, and if you used another one, it worked a different way. We've done a fair amount of cleaning that up. So the language is, I think the general quality of the language has improved. The stuff we're doing, which we're not shipping at PDC, we're definitely we're looking at. So the big two design efforts that are going on in the team right now are adding pattern matching, right? So we're looking at how to get pattern matching into the language, and dealing with update full on. one of the interesting things about M is that we avoided adding update semantics to the language. However, we had these things called extents. And extents were effectively variables that could be modified, but you just couldn't modify them in the language. So we declared their existence, and some external agent, some extra-linguistic machinery would come along and poke on them and change it. And you might be able to observe those side effects in the language, but there was no way to produce them or control them or even think about them. So it was a necessary first step to get the language bootstrapped. But it was obvious to us, you know, I think it was probably obvious around PDC of last year that we needed, people wanted the ability to say, great, you've given me the ability to declare what the shape of my data is, how to build projections in terms of functional querying on top, but you know what? I want people to be able to do updates, and I want control over that. And so that gets you into the update morass.
Yeah. So that's interesting, because once you start talking about pattern matching, you talk about failure, possible failure. Mm-hmm. When you talk about updates, you talk about side effects. So how do you kind of deal with that? Because now you're not in a purely declarative language anymore. And now, like, if you can write functions or whatever that do updates, and whereas, as far as I, you know, like, what I really liked about M is the fact that, you know, types and values were kind of just intermixed. But now, if the value can have side effects, what does that mean to interpret that as a type? Are you really separating side effects from values?
So we use this term on the team called stratification.
Okay.
So we're trying to be disciplined about putting layers in the language where we have control over what the, you know, the semantic commitments we're making are. And so we talk about having a pure value subset where we only have values. We talk about having a functional subset where we can only do functional computation with no side effects and no meaningful notion of state. Certainly no state you can really do anything with. And then, of course, the full meal deal.
And how do you enforce that layering?
Or is we're trying to write the spec that way. We'll likely, I suspect we'll build libraries that only implement some subsets. Certainly, I think when we do the conformance tests, we'll try and factor it that way.
Okay, but you're not thinking of encoding that in the type system, where the types show that, you know, there's a certain effect.
It's a great question. The stance we're trying to hold fast to is values are values, and they're just point in time snapshots of something, and the types over values, the values themselves are immutable. There's this other thing that is stateful. Values aren't state; they're just
Sure. But once you talk about updates, now if I have a query over that thing that's kind of is getting updated,
yep,
which produces a value, that's not now a pure value anymore. My collection will change underneath me.
Well, the result of the expression is a value, right? The result of the computation is a value.
But if I run the computation again, I might get
a different
value.
Absolutely.
So now it's not a function anymore.
I agree. Yeah.
It's not a pure function.
It's not a pure function.
It is not a pure function anymore.
Yes.
Yeah. Or another fun one is, if I refer to the same thing twice in the same expression, am I going to get the same result?
Yes.
I mean, you don't even need to run the query twice. You know, I basically say A plus A, right? Is A going to be the same on both sides of the expression evaluation?
Yeah.
So
the answer is, by the way, it will be the same.
So let's step back just a little bit and talk, because I don't think we've really had this conversation before with Don. And I mean, why did you create M? I mean, what's going on here, man?
Oh, look, the motivation was the project was started to make it so that we could capture more of our software as data. I mean, that was the fundamental principle. Capture more of the program as data. And, quite honestly, make it so that data can be stored in, you know, our premier, you know, storage engine, which is SQL Server, right? SQL Server has lots of really nice characteristics. It's got a transaction processing system in it. It's got a QP in it. And the question was, how can we bring that, you know, very interesting piece of technology to bear on this problem? And we tried all kinds of ways to go make this work. And it became clear that the techniques we were using, which were largely kind of the classic modeling techniques of using, you know, various notations, visual notations or graphical notations, wasn't working out. And the reason it wasn't working out was folks who have a modeling who are in the modeling space are very have no problem working in that space. They often like it. They often like other forms too. But you know, our engineers, the folks who write the code that is the DLL and the EXE of our product, wouldn't use it. You know, they basically just said it's this other thing. And so we've needed a way to have it so that the average programmer, the average coder, the average developer, whatever terminology you want to use, could feel like they had a visceral emotional attachment to this thing they were producing. And so that led us to, well, what do programmers have religion over? It's text editors, right? You want to start a fight in a bar, it's Emacs versus VI. Somebody's going to get a black eye, I guarantee it, right? And so we wanted to basically sand with the grain of that emotional attachment people have. And so we said, we need a great text experience for data. And D was born, right? Mm-hmm. D was the initial code name. Before we got a chance to publicly release, someone leaked to Mary Jo Foley.
Wasn't you.
No, it wasn't me. Dude, don't wink at me. It wasn't me.
I know. Fair enough.
Great. It wasn't me. So we basically, we never wanted that name to get out. It was, you know, D is for data kind of a
thing. Sure, that's a cool name. After C.
Yeah. So we basically had to scramble for a different code name. So we have the new code name, which is code name M, and that name ain't going to stick either. Mm. Right. And what will the real name be?
Something long.
There are people, yes. there are attorneys and marketing people who are, you know, fighting with the product team. We're collaborating on coming up with an awesome name. But I'll tell you, it is a struggle to come up with a product name at Microsoft. It is just.
Eric knows a thing or two about that. Yes. Don't say it.
I'm not allowed to say it.
You're not allowed to say the word anymore.
Yes.
And look, to be fair, you know, we need all of these people to participate, but it's the challenges that the marketing people bring in. They bring in a perspective, which makes it hard. The legal people bring in a perspective, which makes it hard. And then the people who build the product want to have a say, right?
Yeah.
You know, you spend years of your life building this thing. You kind of want to name the baby. Mm-hmm. I'm confident we will come up with an absolutely awesome name, but I have no idea what it is.
Yep. So it's interesting that you know, like you said, like first you start out with like the modeling, like the visual notation, and then you focus on developers. So what is the kind of, you know, where is the, is there really a difference between modeling and coding, or where is the boundary?
It's a very subtle difference. It's a very, very subtle difference. In fact, you can look at M and say it's a programming language. Even with where we're at today, if you go look at the current M spec, which we published, you look at that, it's hard to distinguish between a programming model. You know, we're trying to be more disciplined about the stratification so that, you know, you can do better reasoning about what you're saying at the various levels, but the line's pretty fuzzy. You know, the degrees of commitment you make to a particular runtime environment, to a particular execution model, you know, that's where, you know, in the world of coding and programming, there is absolutely no fuzz involved, right? Because you've got an artifact that's actually executing. In the world of modeling, you may or may not ever execute it, right? You know, we actually really, 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 really honest to God think about the person who's just going to sketch an idea down in M and never run it. Never, ever run it. But we want it so that they can do some sort of model verification on it, like, you know, is it at least syntactically valid, which isn't all that useful? You know, is it self-consistent? Are you making constraints that just are obviously unsatisfiable? So we do think about doing static analysis on stuff that we'll never execute. So, you know, I guess the thing we're trying to achieve with M is a little bit broader than a programming language. But, you know, as our bits evidence, you know, you can run an M model, right? And you can run an M model both in the store because we compile down to T-SQL. And you can also run much of the language today and all of the language by the time we're done in memory as well. So it does have the programming language nature.
And when you mentioned in the beginning you wanted to have programs as data, how does that, did that kind of really constrain the language design? Are there things that you can point at? For example, I can imagine that once you have higher order functions, these are really hard to kind of treat as data. Because now you're really talking about computation, and like you cannot even draw a picture of a higher order function, right? So,
I can draw a perfectly good picture of a higher order function. No one may recognize it, but I can draw a picture
of a higher order function as a value. That would be interesting because I think that's one of the biggest problem, right? You can write the text, but you know, how do you visualize it as a value? You cannot write like a set. You can say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But
well, to be clear, if I can write it as text, I can transform that text into some data rep.
Yep.
Right? And the thing I transform it into is highly subjective, but I can pick something which captures the characteristics I care about. And then I can visualize it because it's in a data structure, and we have ways of visualizing data. Now, will I be able to, put it on the PDC poster and have people say, oh, obviously, that's the higher order function PDC. Great. Asher, screw that. It's higher order functions this year. Whoopee. No. there isn't visual notations for some of this stuff is very subjective. Yeah. But then again, I mean, look, one of my most awesome pieces of software ever written in the world, Les Roeder's Reflector, right? He made some arbitrary choices, I believe, in terms of the little icons he puts by methods and properties and events and fields and types and all that stuff. And yet, everybody knows it. You look at Reflector, and in 5 minutes, you go, oh, yeah, pink triangle means this, or whatever, right? And, ultimately, it's a lot of these things are just convention, right? UML is just a convention, but because everyone's seen so much of it, you kind of look at it, oh, yeah, there's the attributes, there's the operations, great, right? Diamond at the end of the arrow, great, I know what it means. Visualizing higher-order functions, someone will come up with a shape, the pentagon. It'll be a pink pentagon.
Yeah.
And everybody will know it.
So I think it's the concept of programs as data is incredibly interesting because you could imagine where you pass programs to programs. Like in functional program, a function is a value, right, Eric?
Yeah.
I mean, you've been teaching us all this.
Yes.
And you can pass you can have a function that returns functions, right? And that function itself is a value and it's a function that returns. My point is, I'm just trying to think way outside the box.
Well, and that's what we do with link expression trees. But we make that even more obvious, right? Where you can take a representation of a function that you can manipulate. Because that is the problem. Like when you normally pass a higher order function, there's nothing you can do with it. You can only call it. But you cannot manipulate it as data.
Fair enough. But back to what Don had said about programs as data. That's an incredibly interesting concept. What does that mean in a broader picture? So in other words, I can pass functions around, programs around to other programs, pass programs around as a value, as a set of values. That's a really interesting concept, man. I mean, isn't that something that's worth talking about, or am I just...
Yes, but that's an interesting question, because even, that's the whole point of the von Neumann machine, is that programs are data, right? I mean, you have your DLL, your XE, that is data that is interpreted by the computer as code. So in some sense, our whole industry is based on the fact that, we treat code as data.
Yes. Intel makes a really cool interpreter for that data form.
Yes, exactly. So I don't know, Charles.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, though. It's kind of bizarre. I mean, I take this stuff as just completely axiomatic. You do. Charles is illustrative that while in the world I live in on a daily basis, everybody's a compiler geek and everybody's a language geek.
Yes.
There's a... not everyone is. And the question is, how do you get the... I mean, this is ultimately the challenge, which... I don't think we did a great job on at PDC 2008, which was grounding these ideas out so that everybody can understand them. Right? Most programmers, God bless them, and I wish I were this way. I mean, I consider it a psychological defect that I'm not. Most programmers just want to get home at 5, right? I used to tell this I used to have a very colorful story about the VB versus the C++ programmer.
You can tell it. We all know that you love VB, so it's...
I do love VB. Yes, you know, some of my best friends are VB programmers. In fact, half my team is from the VB team. It was the classic, you know, the VB programmer. You know, the C++ programmer would, work long, long hours because he just wanted to and he loved it. And it took him so long because the language was such an obstacle to getting work done. VB programmer, you know... He just wanted to get his job done, solve a business problem, and then go home, and spend time with his wife. And I said, he can get home so early, he can spend time with his wife and the C++ programmer's wife. which was always a fun analogy to talk about.
So, but we were kind of joking a little bit.
The problem is, how do you get these ideas, how do you take these ideas, which are existential and really fun to talk about, and actually make them relevant?
Exactly. Yes. That's what I was saying. We were joking with Charles, but... Yeah. If you look at, like, axes, they are really hard to manipulate. They are data, but, to crack them open and to kind of get the structure out, that's really hard. And if you look at, like you mentioned Reflector, with .NET assemblies, you can already kind of, dig more into the structure. So is there, in M, do you have a very high-level, API or object model for your code, or... You're saying it's you store it in SQL.
Let's be clear. We schematize a compiled program in M.
Okay.
Right. So there's we used to call it the M for M's, it was too cute of a name, but we actually have this notion of a catalog, which is like the reflection model for M, but it's schematized in M, and I can go off and go do interaction with that. I can take any name that I can use in an M program and do about that name and get back. Data, which tells me about what that name's declarations mean. And including that, scrubbing, going all the way down to the expression tree. We don't have a big line, which is funny. In our system, because the way types and expressions interrelate, we don't have a bright line between the world of named declarations and the world of expressions. Right? So we basically have this one thing which we call the semantic graph in the compiler, and we call it the catalog and when we expose it through public data models. But it's the whole program. And you start from the naming hierarchy, the symbol table kind of space. And then you just keep dotting through it, and you keep getting down to, the expression trees, which are type checked and all that. So we kind of have a fairly linear path through the stuff. Unlike, if I look at .NET Reflection, where you've got, system.type and all of that, and then you get into the method body, and it's, okay, great, here's a byte array. Right.
Yeah.
Crack the IL, have fun. And link expression trees are there, but they're not integrated into this machine.
Yeah.
So, we take it pretty seriously.
Another thing that, when you look at .NET Reflection is that there you can kind of bridge the world. Right? I can create something and then execute it. So you've kind of, it blurs the lines between symbolic execution and computation.
Or more interestingly, for me at least, is you can take the program and modify it. Before you execute it. And I don't mean self-modifying code, but I mean basically, if you look at this product we have called Astoria, or ADO.NET Data Services, which is the legal marketing name, one of the things we have in there are query interceptors where, the link tree comes up from the wire, right? So we basically take a query expression, encode it into a URI in a fairly URI-friendly way, which means we don't have a full expression language, but we take the useful parts, bring them over, and then we expose the query to the developer so that they can do things like add additional predicates so they can filter out what data is visible before they actually hit the back end of the store. It's kind of funny. If you look at Astoria, it's like a distributed compiler, right? If you think about the stages of a compiler, we take those stages and just distribute it across the client and mid-tier and then the server if I'm actually hitting a database.
Nice.
It's just the intersection of languages and data is just awesome.
So on that note, systems, just awesome. Because we're taking up a lot of his time, and the bell is tolling, I guess. So let's talk about this. This conversation will continue at the PDC.
At the panel.
Yes. And you're going to be the moderator.
I'll be moderating, and we have people like Don and
and I think we have another.
And all the people that we've seen, Butler Lampson, all the people that
Turing Award
winners, yes. And so I hope that everybody will come to see us live at the PDC.
Absolutely.
Then you get also the opportunity to ask questions.
Yes.
It will be great fun.
And it should be some fun debates.
Yes. Exactly.
Excellent. Right. Hey, thank you for your time, Don.
Thank you.
Great to have you on C9 again, Matt.
As always.
Right on, Eric.
See you next time.
Cheers.